Welcome to today's edition of the Exploring Mining Podcast, featuring stock news from TSX, TSXV, CSE, ASX, NASDAQ, and New York Stock Exchange mining companies, plus interviews with CEOs and leading experts.
Thanks for joining us again on another episode of the Exploring Mining Podcast, featuring an exclusive interview with silver expert Peter Kraut, where we recap the year that was 2023. In this episode, we finish the year with discussions of all things silver and gold, including the new LME contracts announced this week. Peter gives his forecast for 2024 on gold and silver and breaks down what to look for in silver juniors. We talked about Hercules Silver's one of his picks from 2023, up 700%, and jurisdictions he likes, including Bolivia. Peter is the author of the best-selling book, The Great Silver Bull. He's also a frequent guest speaker on silver at many mining events around the world and an expert in the precious metals markets. He runs a silver-focused investment newsletter, Silver Stock Investor. To reach out to Peter or learn more, www.silverstockinvestor.com. Peter, welcome back to the show. We're going to do a little bit of a recap since the last time we talked. A lot can happen in 40 days. I'll give you the floor and you can just talk about what's happened and what's of interest right now.
Sure. Well, yes, thanks, Kelly, again for having me. And you're right, a lot can happen and a lot has happened. You know, what we've seen, and I think that maybe some of your listeners may not realize, but around sort of mid-October to November, we had a couple of things happen. You had the US dollar index peak around 107. We're today around 102. That's a big drop in just a couple of months. We've also had most of the US Treasury yield curve was at or above 5%. Now most of it's below 5%. In fact, the 10-year Treasury is at about 3.9, I think, if last I checked. That's a huge drop from nearly 5%. And this was right around, I'm going to say, late October, early November. So that's just tremendous. And that's the 10-year Treasury is what most of, I guess, the world watches to see what's happening with interest rates. So I guess these aggressive rate hikes that the Fed and other central banks have been having have really started to kick in, which is in some ways good. It's interesting. It's certainly got inflation to cool down considerably. But the flip side of it is, you know, it's a bit of a double-edged sword. Now that, you know, things like yields are so much lower, that means that borrowing has become cheaper. So mortgage rates have come down, corporate bond yields have come down. So that means that it could become somewhat stimulative at this point or sometime soon in terms of economic activity. And yet interest or inflation rates are only down to about 3.1%. So that's way down from last year's peak of around 9%. And yet it's still 50% above the Fed's target of 2%. So although we're not, you know, we're still considerably above, I'm going to say considerably above what the Fed has as its target, you know, they've still decided to lean dovish in this latest Fed FOMC meeting. And I think that's really important to note. I think they see that, yes, inflation's come a long way down, and yet I think they see things have stabilized considerably. And although there is a lag effect and we could continue to see more drops in terms of inflation rates, I think they do realize that we are, in fact, at what they call the terminal rate. So unlikely rates will go higher at this point. More than likely, they'll stay stable for a little while and start being cut last year. So that was the outcome of last week's Fed meeting. On that day, gold was up 2.5%. Silver was up 5%, which is just tremendous in a single day. And, you know, that's a recap of where we are. I still think that odds are pretty high for a recession next year, if not in Q1, then in Q2. And rates will start to be cut either in Q2 or mid-year. So that should be ongoing stimulation for, I think, the whole precious metals and even to some extent the commodities sector. That's I temper that with a little bit with the fact that if you have recession, base metals and certain other commodities may suffer, energy included. But the precious metals, gold in particular, should actually do really quite well.
Speaking of things that are just coming out, today they had the London Metal Exchange just announced that they're planning to launch new metal contracts using prices from the Shanghai Future Exchange. Do you think that we are going to see more contracts like that and new ideas like that coming out in 2024? And do you think that will make an impact too much on gold and silver in the future?
Yes, I do, because I haven't delved into it a lot, but I have several times over the last few months read a few headlines about how if you look at pricing in China or Asia, for example, there is maybe not huge, but there is a notable gap still in terms of pricing between there and the West. You know, the fact that the LME is willing to make this considerable change, to me says that they see where the market is for precious metals. It clearly is east. It's flowing from west to east. And because of that, they're having more impact on ultimate pricing. So it makes sense that if larger and larger volumes are being traded and amounts of silver and gold are being bought out in the east, that they're having more impact on the price. And if there's a difference in pricing and they're buying that much more, then that their pricing should have a higher impact on you know, what we're quoting as actual spot prices. So that makes sense to me. I'm not completely surprised. And an interesting development too. I mean, you know, I'm obviously all about silver, but naturally I follow gold very closely as well. And what I find interesting is that despite so many headwinds for gold this year, it really has been very robust. High rates a strong dollar, high interest rates because the Fed had been raising rates at least up until July. So as I said earlier, we had yields around 5%, and competing with high yield money market instruments, and in the last couple of months, a broad stock market that has really been rallying very strongly. So gold in the face of this has stayed very, very robust, very close to 2000. And in the last sort of 3 weeks, except for, I believe it's just a couple of days, has been above $2,000. So, you know, actually peaked and set a new all-time high around $2,140. This would have been in the evening of December 3rd on a Sunday night. That sold off quickly the next day. And then just for a couple of days since then, we've been below 2000, around 1980. And that bounced right back. We've been back above. And I've been telling my subscribers that the longer we spend above 2000, the less likely we're going to go back below it. I believe that starts to form a new floor in the price of gold. And for what it's worth, it's, an important psychological level. 2000, big round numbers are easy for people to notice and to remember. And there was an very interesting anecdote that Costco reported that in its last quarter, its last fiscal quarter, it sold $100 million worth of gold, 1 ounce gold bars. These bars, they would stock them for not more than a couple of hours at a time. They would just get snapped up immediately, and members were only allowed to buy two bars at a time, and they just could not keep them in stock. So despite the fact that there seems to be a lot of, I'm not going to say necessarily disdain, but maybe lack of interest in precious metals overall, gold remains very strong. And I think that this anecdote from Costco tells me that you've got, to some extent, generalists, because that's a lot of gold. and to buy from Costco, not to mention all the other dealers, right? All the other bullion dealers that have their ongoing business. So that says to me that to some extent, you've got the generalist investor's ear, and eyes, and they're starting to pay attention. They're starting to come into that market. They are looking for deals because Costco is selling below below typical spot prices. So they are getting deals, but that's a lot of volume to move, and so people are starting to pay attention to gold. And as I started out saying, to see gold prices this resilient in face of all of the other opportunities and options that people have to invest in, says to me that it's going somewhere. I've been going on for a little while, but one other sort of little note that I think is interesting to keep in mind, and I think one of the big things that's driving this support in gold prices is the amount of buying that's really coming from central banks. So we talked about the demand in the East and how the LME is now going to price off of Chinese contracts. Well, a lot of the buying is from the East. A lot of the central bank buying is from emerging market central banks. They feel they don't have enough gold. They also feel they have too many U.S. dollars. So they're trying to sell U.S. treasuries that, as the yields went up, that meant that their values had gone down. And so that was probably stinging them. And so they want to get out of treasuries, out of dollars, and they've been buying a lot of gold. Last year was a huge all-time record of 1,083 tons of gold bought by central banks. And we are on pace this year to be, again, well over 1,000 tons of gold. And if you look at that's an all-time record, but if you look at even in the last few years, the nearest high was like 600 tons. So that is a huge huge pace of demand. And I think that has really helped as well to keep gold prices really high and sustained high. So I think we're going to see new records being set next year in gold. Not new records in silver, but long-term highs we're likely to see in silver.
All right. That's a good answer. I'm sure all the gold investors are going to be happy and running to Costco right now.
Yeah, that's right.
So you talked about the floor for gold. Do you see a new floor with silver right now? I mean, we were pretty close. I think last time we talked, we were talking about it making it to 26. It did for a minute. And then we're back around the 24 range. That's kind of our new floor. And there's lots of people talking about it going to 50 next year, but I won't be that generous.
Right. Me either. despite being a long-term silver bull, so I'd agree with your call for 24. I think that will form as a new floor in the silver price. I think that's a bit of a magnet. It's going to continue to trade around that level, maybe a little above, a little below. But I do think that will start to form a new support in the silver price. And, if you look at, we can talk about that in a moment, but what's driving silver, I do think that, I'll get my forecast out of the way now. I think that in the first half of next year, we'll potentially see silver reach about $28. So that's a good run from where we are now. A few things will drive that. And then I think in the second half of next year, we can see it test $30. I'm not prepared to call for $50 next year. That would be just basically a doubling from where we are now, more than doubling. That's really aggressive. And for a couple of reasons, one of them being that silver does not perform as well as gold does through recessions. And I do expect one. It tends to somewhat outperform before on balance, and it tends to outperform coming out of recessions as well. But during sort of the middle part of a recession, it does not perform as well as gold. And that's why I think that to see, $50 silver would really completely surprise even me for next year. Really, we've talked about this before, but 3/4 of silver production is byproduct from mining other metals like gold, copper, lead, and zinc. So much of silver really does not depend on mining silver, but mining other metals. And those companies, it's interesting. So here's a little sort of, a little bit of insight on the silver market. I'm not sure if we've talked about this before, but with so much of silver coming from mining other metals, what happens is it depends on the output of those metals. If you get a recession, then there may be some easing up on the production of base metals, because those are industrial metals. If you have an economic slowdown, there'll be less demand for base metals, typically. And so if you have less demand for base metals and less production of base metals, the production of silver will likely slow down as well. And because the silver contribution to those miners is relatively small to their revenues, they don't do much about it. And even if let's say silver prices did run up to $30, again, because it's such a small portion of their revenue, they're just happy to take a higher price for silver, and they don't necessarily make much effort to try and produce more silver. It's hard enough to try and ramp up a mine to begin with. There's so many steps involved. But even if it were easy, it's not that significant for them. So they just happily accept a higher price and keep producing, the amounts that they were in the past. So you have this supply inelasticity of silver, which means that higher prices almost inevitably beget higher prices in that kind of scenario, because there's no reaction from supply to try and produce more. So you've got these higher prices and you've got this stagnant or perhaps even falling supply that perhaps will exacerbate to even higher prices. So it's a really interesting dynamic in terms of how that can all play out. So that I think that's one of the reasons that you have this volatility too in silver. And when it runs, it really can run pretty dramatically.
So you're making my job easy. You're answering questions for me. I love it. Speaking of silver, Silver Institute has come up with new updates. Do you want to share some of the insights and where we're at for the close of the year?
Yeah, absolutely. So they usually come out with their full year forecast in April, and then mid-November they have what we call an interim update, which is, they make adjustments and to what they feel would be more accurate numbers for the full year of 2023. And so one of the big things is that they've, when you just look at pure supply and demand, they now see that overall total supply will actually be down 2%, mostly because mine supply will be down, and that's despite a little bit of a bounce in recycling. So overall demand, however, will also be lower, but will still be the second highest level on record. And so we're talking about overall demand easing by about 10%, and despite demand easing from last year, where we had record demand, they still see a supply deficit. So last year we had a 253 million ounce deficit. This year they're calling for 140 million ounce shortfall. I think that next year we're going to still see another shortfall. They have called for ongoing supply deficits in the silver market, just because demand is so robust and growing, and because supply is falling overall on balance. It's at the very least stable, but not even close to where, mine supply is around 800 million ounces a year. Overall supply is about 1 billion ounces. The rest is mostly made up from recycling. And yet mine supply peaked back in 2016, so like 7 years ago, at around 900 million ounces. And there was a recent bit of research from Bank of America, and they surveyed the 13 largest silver miners, and they came out with a result that they feel that we're not going to reach that peak of mine supply from 2016 anytime soon, that we're going to continue to kind of trudge along where we are in terms of output. And that's despite strong and growing demand. And sort of the biggest bit of news, I guess, from the Silver Institute is reflected in industrial demand this year. That's going to reach a total of 632 million ounces out of 1 billion ounces. So 63% of all silver demand this year is going to be from the industrial side. And it's driven mostly from by the green transition and the technologies, things like solar panels, upgrading of the power grid, 5G telecom, EVs, EV chargers, all that sort of thing. So if we look specifically, and, you know, the elephant in the room, my view, and for the last couple of years, and I think that's going to continue to be the case for several more years, is the solar demand for silver. In 2021, that was 110 million ounces. Last year, it was already 140 million ounces. In the Institute's survey, which was published in April, they said this year it would be 161 million ounces, and then they revised that in November from 161 to 190 million ounces. And for the record, since earlier this year, I have been calling for about 180 to 190 million ounces demand for the solar industry, the solar sector. So my forecast was closer and earlier. and that's a 73% jump in solar demand for silver in just 2 years. It's just off the charts. Solar is 30% of industrial demand alone for silver. And so, you know, there's a huge growth in production capacity for solar panels. China continues to dominate that. They represent 80% of worldwide production capacity for solar. And we may have talked about this before, but I think it bears repeating. What's happening in solar is that you have this dominant technology that goes by the acronym PERC, P-E-R-C. And then there are a couple of others, newer ones, that are more efficient. One's called TOPCon, the other is HJT. TOPCon requires 50% more silver per panel, and HJT requires 150% more silver per panel. So, you know, your listeners may be asking, why would you put more silver into a solar panel? Well, it's all numbers. And the reason is because you get higher efficiencies. The extra silver is worthwhile because you get that much more energy out of the panel with this new technology. So about 3 years ago, these two technologies combined were only about 10% of production capacity. This year, they already have grown to 35% of annual production capacity. So over the last like 10 years, we've seen silver loadings, which is the amount of silver required per panel, fall pretty steadily. In the last couple of years, it's kind of leveled off. And I believe that we are now, if we get to see charts of silver loadings, that we're probably at a bottom. In other words, the amount of silver loadings, as I say, is the amount of silver required per panel. I believe that we're going to start to see that line start to trend back upwards, meaning the amount of silver required per panel is at least going to stay flat or start to rise. And that's because of the adoption of these new technologies. Industrial demand overall is, you know, it's just so robust, and it's being driven by these different things like 5G telecom, electronics, things like medicine, because silver is such a great biocide. It kills the bacteria. There are multiple uses for silver that just continue to drive the use of it. And we're seeing patents, new patents for silver applications, almost like on a weekly basis. It's very impressive.
I was just reading this week, actually, about for the green transition. They're actually looking at the Toyota Research Institute and Stanford's lab, that they're putting silver in for hydrogen fuel cell technology. And some of the people are saying that that will actually surpass solar demand by 2026.
Oh, my goodness.
Which is to keep us all busy.
I'm going to have a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
That's just 3 years away, and that would be tremendous. And I actually read that article too. I didn't see that last part about how it could drive, you know, to surpass solar by 2026, but I did see about how using silver in hydrogen batteries could be a huge new source of demand for silver. So, I mean, where all this silver is supposed to come from, I have no idea. It's definitely becoming more and more of an industrial metal. But I think that the interesting part about, we talked earlier about recession, And when people start to become concerned about how the economy is doing, and we just have to look back to what happened in 2020 when silver went from a low of $12 to $30 in the space of about 7 months, or 5 months, I think it was. During recession, you know, you've got this counterbalance that people will potentially, will first go to gold because it's the standard in terms of sort of safety. But then as gold, you know, rises in price, they look for an alternative. And silver is the natural alternative. It's been money for thousands of years, in fact. And so I wouldn't discount the attraction of silver as a safe haven and as an investment, as opposed to being used as a physical metal. If you'd like, I can jump into a little bit about what the Silver Institute has talked about in terms of demand on from a couple of other sectors, being physical and investment and so on in the past year, and what they're expecting going forward, and how, you know, sort of what my thoughts of where that that might end up going.
For sure.
Okay, so let's jump into it. Physical demand, they're forecasting down by 21%, but that's dropping from a massive year last year of 333 million ounces, so that it would reach about 263 million ounces that this year. That's still really high historically. As I say, I think that the odds of recession might counterbalance some expected weakness next year. I think physical demand in 2024 could reach about 290 million ounces, although this year will be closer to 260. Then you've got things like silver ETFs. They saw huge demand in 2020. That was 331 million ounces. And then that scaled back quite a bit, but there was still net investment going into ETFs. In 2021, 65 million ounces. And then last year, we had net outflows of about 126 million ounces and about 40 million ounces of outflows again this year. I think that, as I say, you know, because of the safe haven attraction, we'll actually probably see some net inflows in 2024. I think we're going to see around 80 million ounces. That's, you know, being driven by falling interest rates. Keep in mind, too, that you know, lower bond yields and cutting interest rates takes away the opportunity cost of owning gold and silver, because obviously if a bond pays a high yield, money markets pay high yields, if the US dollar is strong, that makes those assets attractive. But as the dollar falls, as bonds pay lower yields, you take away their attractiveness, and then when people look at gold and silver versus those other assets, they'll say, well, you know, my opportunity cost isn't as high anymore. Maybe it makes sense for me to own some gold or silver. So, you know, that this year also, what has happened is that there's been a fair bit of softening of demand from things like silverware and silver jewelry. The year prior, last year, was really very strong, especially because India had loaded up so strongly. There is a huge market for silver, and so that's probably going to temper somewhat next year. And so, you know, you've got ebb and flow, that's for sure. I think that if we do see rate cuts next year, I still don't see us going back to the Fed's 2% target overall. I think inflation is going to stay about probably where it is in terms of a low. And then ultimately, perhaps towards the end of next year, we could start to see it rise again. And so that's why I think that silver prices will remain pretty robust throughout all of 2024.
We talked a little bit about, you know, maybe not 50, but the $30 price. See a lot more of the juniors maybe coming online and producing getting close to producing if we reach, you know, that $28 to $30 level. I mean, you see with uranium right now, there's a lot of M&A and JV going on. Do you think at a certain price with silver, we'll start to see some of that happening with the miners on the silver side? We have accessed a lot of already the tier one properties out there. If that's even
right.
Possible or?
Yeah, I mean, so naturally the higher price will make a lot of projects instantaneously, more economic. Or, you know, either that things that were either borderline economic will suddenly become economic, and some things that were economic will be dramatically more economic. The problem is always the time it takes to move some of these projects, you know, through permitting, through construction, and then getting them to be production ready. I kind of hesitate to think that there's going to be much fast tracking. It's very difficult. The only place I can see, you know, sort of a quick turnaround is any project that may have been put on care and maintenance because it wasn't economic to operate around, say, you know, the current price level, 22, 24, maybe even slightly higher. But as you get to, you know, the 26, the 27 price levels, and certainly up to 30, as I say, many, many more projects become attractive. The question is, how many of them are out there that can, you know, be switched on pretty quickly? And I don't think there are that many, frankly. As I say, you know, so much silver comes from silver byproduct. And so only about a quarter of all silver is what we call primary silver mining. I don't see that many mines that are sort of waiting around on care and maintenance, waiting for a higher silver price than that could be started back up pretty quickly. So I think that's going to exacerbate, a potentially higher price still for silver. And, we've got some challenges. One example is in Mexico, which is the world's largest silver producing nation. Well, they've become a little bit more hostile towards mining, and they in the last year. And when I say they, I say that because of the current government, which is supposed to change by next fall. However, the likely new leader for that government is apparently even more aggressive. On the environmental side. And so that is somewhat being tempered by the fact that they've been losing some court battles when some of the laws that they want to bring in are being challenged. So there is some potential for the aggressiveness against mining to be scaled back. But that still doesn't change the fact that there are some headwinds, especially for open pit mining. And that tends to be a cheaper way to mine. So, all that to say that there are challenges that lie ahead to try to bring more and more silver production online. There just isn't that much of it out there. Silver mines are rare, especially high-grade silver mines. And there is a handful of sort of medium and larger producers. Mostly, though, what I've seen is these are producers that mine silver as a byproduct. So they're not even sort of in quote unquote true silver miners. So that's kind of my view of where, you know, the potential for a supply reaction to higher prices stands right now. But I would say that given the growth in demand and the risk of sort of volatile demand coming in very quickly and perhaps being sustained, which is what we saw in 2020 for investment demand for silver, which drove premiums like through the roof. In some places, premiums had gone to something like 75 to even, I believe I had read 100% premiums on some silver in places like India, not for very long, but ever since, even prior to 2020, premiums have been extremely high in the 30 to maybe even 40% range above spot, where traditionally premiums are supposed to be anywhere from about 12 to 15% above spot prices. So premiums have gone high and have actually stayed high for a long time. I just think that the ongoing growth in demand and new applications for silver are going to lead to ongoing deficits. Even if we saw $30 prices, the lag, the time lag to bring production to market and the ongoing growth in demand would at best probably see perhaps the deficits shrink, but I don't see them going away, not for many, many years. I think the only cure for this is going to potentially be at some point much, much higher silver prices. There's good and bad about that. You know, if you own some silver or silver companies and their prices just go bonkers, I would absolutely, you know, suggest taking some profits, at least partial profits, because that can't last. There are so many practical applications for silver. It's there's no substitute in many cases. There just is absolutely no substitute for silver for so many uses that if the price went crazy, that would just wreak so much havoc in so much industry. I mean, I don't know how that would play out. And there's no way that the mine supply can react quickly to adjust for it. So, if you see some wild moves in the silver price and the miners and the explorers follow, take some profits. It reminds me of what we saw in early 2021 when we had that silver squeeze, where you had this Reddit phenomenon that where you had some people calling for a squeeze on silver. And so they were saying, you know, go out and buy a bunch of silver so that silver ETFs are forced to go out or buy silver ETFs. So they're forced to go out and buy silver. And so silver went crazy. I don't remember the exact numbers, but it just absolutely soared over a matter of a few days. Many of the miners had, I do recall, anywhere from about 5 to 7 times normal trading volumes in the space of a few days, and bullion dealers went wild. I mean, their phone systems would crash. They could not handle all the calls. Many of them that have been in business for decades do not ever remember witnessing or living through anything like that at all. And the interesting part was that a lot of it was small orders. You had mainly generalist investors reacting to this, calling in and saying, I just want a few ounces. I want 5 ounces. I want 10 ounces. And, they were having to tell them, I'll take your order, but I can't deliver for at least several weeks, whereas, you know, prior it was a matter of a few days, normal delivery. So you do get these kinds of events that happen in silver. For that to happen again would absolutely not surprise me. I mean, I wrote about that in detail in my book, The Great Silver Bull. So if anybody wants an account of what happened over those days and weeks, it's pretty interesting. There even over the following months, because there were some odd things that happened with some of the futures exchanges as well, and the inventories. So I'm going to leave it at that. But and not get into any kind of conspiracy theories, but some odd things happened. I do not discount at all the possibility of this kind of action happening again. Silver just lends itself to that kind of activity.
Speaking of profits, you know, miners doing well. Hercules,
right,
is one of your picks. I wanted to just go over for someone that maybe hasn't joined your newsletter or is thinking about joining it. What made you pick Hercules as one of your top picks? And then can you kind of go over some of how you make your decision? Is it property-based jurisdiction? Is it the management, a combination? Like, how do you pick a 600% return winner?
Well, you know, you do get lucky sometimes. I'll start with that. That is a standout. There's no question about it. It's been a relatively overall tough year for silver mining and silver exploration pretty much across the board. There is a handful of exceptions. The absolute best companies have either treaded water, which is pretty decent. Some have been outstanding. This is a true standout, perhaps one of the best standouts. We were lucky enough to get in at 18 cents, and as I look at my screen right now, it's trading at $1.48. So that's about a 700% return. And I've told subscribers, take some profits, because impossible to know, you know, where that's going to go. But I suggested only partial profits, because I do think that there's a lot of gas left in that tank. I mean, what drew me to Hercules was a few things. One is jurisdiction. We're talking about Idaho, Western Idaho. Idaho has historically been a huge silver production state, silver producing state. Some of the biggest silver mines in the U.S. Are in Idaho. It has, you know, a great, great geology, and management has a good track record. They knew what they were doing. Obviously, like anything, it's exploration. You're taking chances, but they acquired a property that had very, very good potential. And they used a lot of technology to do geophysics and to do things like soil sampling and to target well in terms of drilling. And so what it's looking like is that there is a sizable silver deposit, but that perhaps or not perhaps, but it's looking very much like directly below that there is likely a copper porphyry. And you know, they hit, if memory serves me right, something like 150 meters of high content of copper. I can't remember exactly right now, but it was enough that within a few weeks, a super major being Barrick stepped in and made a huge investment in the company and said, we want a piece of this. It's in a great jurisdiction again, and Barrick is attracted to the copper side of it, I believe. You know, this is unheard of for a major to come in that quickly after one impressive drill hole. But, from what I've heard and read, the geologists that have looked at these rocks, the drill core, are sufficiently impressed by what they've seen, and they do believe that this is very much likely to get a lot bigger. And so what's impressive is that, you know, Hercules so far has had this big run-up and has maintained itself. So there's a lot to be said for that. It does look like, I mean, we're at $1.48. Barrick got in at $1.10. So already, you know, they are in the money in terms of with their investment. I just think this has a long way to go. And what's interesting and sort of reassuring is that it speaks to the fact that even in a difficult market, discoveries get rewarded. And this is a pretty big discovery, and it's certainly being rewarded by the market. So, that's sort of the summary on Hercules. And if I think about other, you know, how I choose companies, well, there are for sure a few filters to go through. One of the first ones is jurisdiction. And, you know, that's not a sort of hard and fast rule for me. I am willing to make change my mind about certain places. Sometimes that's because perhaps a certain company has a certain advantage. One place that comes to mind is Bolivia. And so I feel that from what I've seen, heard, read, and spoken to others about, is that if you look at South America, Bolivia, or Latin America, Bolivia has a history of being potentially a difficult place to work. But there are ways to work around some of the challenges. I also feel that Bolivia is perhaps a decade or a decade and a half of the kinds ahead of the kinds of rumbling that we're hearing in places like Chile and Peru lately, where they have become somewhat more hostile towards mining. So to sum it up, I guess I would say that Bolivia has been there, done that in terms of how they've treated mining. And it's just too important for them. So they've decided to back off and to be friendlier overall towards the mining sector. And that has made certain plays more attractive. And the smart companies go in there with a certain approach. In other words, you can perhaps acquire land or projects that are held privately. So if you do that, you have less need to deal with the government. If there are no artisanal miners, for example, who are working on any of that land, then that's another issue that you will perhaps have avoided. So again, there are certain things that you can always do that will help sort of to mitigate your risks in a particular jurisdiction. And so that's why I've slowly warmed up to Bolivia. There's a very small handful of companies in the portfolio that have exposure to or are mostly in Bolivia. And those are the ones I feel comfortable with because of, as I say, the approach that they've taken towards that country and how their operations work there. So jurisdiction is a big one. There's no question about that. That definitely limits the kinds of places where there are attractive projects. But if I look overall, that means that the places that are attractive in terms of silver, and you just do not find silver spread around the world the way you do other metals. So the attractive places are places like Australia, the Americas, North and South and Central, and then some parts of Western Europe, and frankly, really, not much else. Because as I say, you do not find silver everywhere. There is a fair bit in Russia. That's pretty much a no-go right now. Not the easiest place to invest in publicly anyways. Those tend to be the jurisdictions. And then, you know, we've talked about management. Of course, you want to look for a track record. When you look at how a company is managed, you want to see a decent treasury. That will help you through some tough times. That's not always the easiest thing to manage as far as an investor goes, because you could buy into a company that has sufficient funds, and then that plays out over, let's say, a year or a couple of years, and because of unfortunate circumstances, let's say they don't come across of a discovery or a hit of any kind that helps to support the share price, and then you found yourself over, as I say, a year or two, the share price may have trended downwards. They may have spent a good chunk of what they had in the treasury earlier, and now they're finding themselves having to raise money at a depressed share price. So there are certain things you can do to try and mitigate, but I'm going to say it's almost impossible to completely avoid those kinds of situations. And that's why you diversify. You don't just buy, you know, two or three juniors. If you're playing in the junior space, I feel that you need to be at least five, probably better 10, and spread it around across, this sort of higher number of companies to mitigate those risks.
Again, making my job easy for me today. To just close up a little bit, do you want to talk for any of the listeners that have not listened to our other podcasts about your newsletter, where they can find it, where they can find your book and everything about you?
Yeah, of course. Sure. Thank you. So I write what, as far as I know, is the only silver-focused investment newsletter. It's called Silver Stock Investor. So you can find that at silverstockinvestor.com. I write a bi-monthly newsletter that covers everything from physical silver all the way down to junior explorers, everything in between, silver ETFs, silver equity ETFs, royalty companies, large and medium and small producers, developers, and junior explorers. And I last year in the spring published a book called The Great Silver Bull, which is, I guess, for me, it's really a synopsis of the entire opportunity, really, is the best way to put it in silver. What I did was I said, anybody who's interested in this space and investing in this space, and it doesn't mean having to invest in the risky opportunities. It could be just understanding the silver space. And even if you choose to only go towards physical silver, it will still have been worth reading the book. But if you choose to go all the way to the higher risk plays, you have an overview of why silver is important, why it's been money for something like 5,000 years, what the opportunity is, the macro picture right now globally, in terms of, you know, fiat currencies, in terms of interest rates and so on, in terms of the opportunity for this decade with inflation. I talk about the dynamics about the silver market, which we did earlier in this call, in terms of supply and demand and what is driving that market on both sides. And then I talk about how you would want to build a silver portfolio that suits you as an investor based on your own risk profile. So that's what the book, The Great Silver Bull, is all about. And it's available on Amazon in paperback, in Kindle, and in audiobook version. So you just need to do a search on Amazon. You'll find all those options available to you. And that essentially summarizes what I do. You can find me on what used to be called Twitter, now X. I'm at Peter_Kraut. I'm also on LinkedIn at Peter Kraut. And so these are multiple ways that you can find me, follow me, and reach out if you want to connect.
Great. And for any of the West Coast following, you will be at the Vancouver Resource Conference and Metals Investor Forum in January, correct?
That's exactly right. So Metals Investor Forum is going to be the 19th and 20th of January, followed by the Vancouver's Resource Investment Conference, which is the 21st and 22nd of January. So I'll be at both of those speaking and presenting companies in the case of the Metals Investor Forum. And if anybody wants to head out to that and connect, hopefully we can do that and we can talk about silver. I'd be happy to do so.
Well, thank you so much for joining the show today, Peter. Always a wealth of knowledge and a fun way to end the year.
Well, Callie, as always, it's been my pleasure, and I'd like to wish you and all your listeners a very happy holiday season, Christmas, and or anything else you might celebrate, a happy new year, and a healthy and prosperous new year above all.
Well, that does it for today's Exploring Mining podcast. If you'd like to be a guest or sponsor for this podcast, please contact investorideas.com. Investorideas.com reminds all listeners to read our disclaimers and disclosures on the investorideas.com website. All investment involves risk, and this podcast is not meant to be an endorsement to buy or sell securities or products. To hear more podcasts, you can go to investorideas.com/audio. And a reminder, you can also hear our podcasts on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play Music, iHeart.com, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spreaker, and SoundCloud.